Hi, Jamel.
Hey, Peter.
How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
I am doing excellent. So I guess before we get going here, we should probably introduce ourselves. I am Peter Suderman, an associate editor at Reason Magazine.
And I am Jamel Bowie, a writing fellow at The American Prospect and a Knopfler fellow at The Nation magazine.
Well, it's great to talk to you today. I guess the big news, two of the big items in the news right now are what didn't happen yesterday. The first is that Chris Christie once again failed to run for president. You sort of finally declined. It was like, the very end of the last Lord of the Rings films. After you'd had all of these endings, it was over, and then it was over again, and then it was over one more time, and now it's finally over, I guess, at least until 2016 or whatever. And it seems a little strange to me that he spent all this time declining, all this time saying there's absolutely no way that I am going to run for president, and then kind of in the last couple of weeks hinting to people that he might in fact run for president, only to at the end once again reaffirm that no, he is not running for president.
Right. I mean, I think it makes a little bit of sense, right? Chris Christie clearly wants to be president someday. He's definitely on the short list for top contenders in 2016 if Barack Obama wins re-election. But I've always thought that for anyone interested in running for president, there's no real point in playing this sort of will I, won't I game if you think that you might win. If you think you stand a decent chance of winning, then you should just jump into the race. There are too many variables. If you're the kind of person who wants to be president, it's very easy to get into the pattern of next time will be a good year. Next time will be a good year. But I mean, the simple fact is there's too many variables at play. You know, Barack Obama might not win, in which case, let's say Mitt Romney becomes president in 2012 and he serves two terms. It's not until 2020 that you're up again, and the odds of you getting the nomination have just declined drastically. So best time to jump in is always now. If Chris Christie thinks he can win, he should jump in. And what I think happened is that Chris Christie did sort of like the early stages of campaigning internally among GOP elites and fundraisers and realized that despite the loudness of calls for him to enter the race, that the actual constituency he would have was quite small. And so bowed out.
So I actually, your description there of your argument that you should just jump in, I think I basically buy that, which is why this seemed like such an odd tactical decision to me. Chris Christie is somebody who it seems reasonable to assert that he has some presidential ambition. He's not entirely opposed to the idea of running for president at some point in his lifetime and would probably like to be president. And the reason that he could win this year is not that Chris Christie is the only person who could beat Obama. The reason that he could win is that Obama is beatable. And I think and that's why, people wanted him in, is because they wanted to make sure that in a race in which Obama is beatable, they had a candidate that they really liked in a lot of ways. And so it seems sort of odd to me for him to give up this, if he wants to do it. He's now basically said, I understand that, even understanding that Obama is perhaps beatable, I'm going to let somebody else take that slot, that potentially just like a winning Republican slot. I mean, Republicans, to a large extent, could nominate not quite anybody.
There's a wide range of people that could nominate.
Yeah, and so Christie declined that sort of easy in, which makes me think that, I don't know. I'm not quite sure maybe you're right that he never had a constituency. Kevin Drum wrote something a while back looking at a New York Magazine piece going over, the places where where Christie diverged from the GOP base on gun control, on immigration, on, you know, sort of the threat of Sharia law, on global warming, on a bunch of things. I agree with him. I actually think he's pretty good on a lot of those issues. Maybe not as much on the gun control side. But I actually thought that to me, that made the case that Christie should run. You know, if only to have somebody there who the GOP couldn't ignore,
right?
Who could make a case on immigration? Who could sort of who could say no? Global warming is a thing that's happening. There's a human contribution to it. The end. You know, and they couldn't simply dismiss him at that.
Essentially, someone with John Huntsman's views who wasn't as much of a wet blanket as John Huntsman is.
Right, he had, you know, but also was really tough on the big issues that certainly many of the issues that I think matter, the spending, economic issues, but that the GOP base certainly is actually more focused on right now.
Right.
And Chris Christie could have potentially refocused the debate as well as, you know, and refocused the party, given them, you know, on issues that are arguably a lot more important. Spending, budgeting issues, that sort of thing, and done that fairly well, and he decided not to. It reads less like a tactical decision and more like he really didn't feel like he wanted to do it, like he was ready, a genuine personal decision.
You know. It could be that. I also have a suspicion that maybe Republicans aren't as confident about 2012 as they have put on publicly. You know, Obama's definitely beatable. He's vulnerable, but I don't. It's not in the bag yet, right? It's not the case that, like, no matter who they nominate, that person will win. And the fact that, you know, Mitch Daniels declines to get in, Haley Barbour, sort of everyone down the line declines to get in, I think it's a sign that, like, maybe people aren't as optimistic. Maybe, like, on a scale of 1 to 10, or, you know, percentage-wise, I think there's, like, a good 50-50 odds of beating Obama, not 60-40 or 70-30, sort of the odds necessary for, you know, everyone to jump in. I don't know.
I think that's one way to read it, and it's certainly – it's certainly plausible, but let me give you two alternative explanations.
Right,
is that all the favorites of the elite favorites who have bowed out have all been made well aware of the ordeal that running for president would entail.
Right.
And all seemed somewhat reticent to undertake that. You know, even though all of them are, you know, alpha types who have, you know, have done a lot in their careers, who have succeeded in huge ways. You know, Mitch Daniels, Haley Barbour. These are not people who are lazy by any stretch of the imagination. I think all, you know, both of those guys knew, and Chris Christie knows, that running for president is just an incredible physical, mental strain, you know, over the course of a year that even in the best environment has no guarantee of paying off.
Right. Even,
you know, no matter how much the odds are stacked in your favor, there's just no guarantee, and everybody knows that. So you can only sort of bet that you're going to go through this and not, you know, and come out winning on the other side. The other thing, though, that I wonder is that with these candidates who are more sort of a little more wonky, a little more policy focused, a little more focused on the actual processes of governance, of deal making, of politicking. You know, I mean, Haley Barbour, whatever you have to say about him, the guy knows how to manage politics and the political process.
Right.
And Mitch Daniel is as close to a wonk as you get in politicians, right?
Right.
And I get the sense from a lot of them, you know, that a lot of them weren't quite sure they wanted to deal with a GOP base that is not interested in either the details of the political process and managing sort of a traditional political process, or in policy details. Right. And that's not what the GOP base is fired up about right now. They're fired up. They're angry. They're upset. You know, they want to beat Obama, but the policy process is not what they care about. They're not, you know, out there looking at the details of how to manage Medicaid programs like Mitch Daniels has and Haley Barbour, have to some extent. They're not out there wanting to figure out how to cut deals in Congress and use legislative maneuvers to get their bills through. They want war. They want somebody who will talk a big game, swing a big stick. And I don't think beyond that, I'm not sure what they want, which in some ways is why you get Mitt Romney running the way he's running.
Right. That's interesting. You know, yeah, because for candidates who are willing to deal with that, and Mitt Romney is very clearly willing to deal with that, it's sort of – I think it minimizes any differences they might have if elected, right? Like right now, there are all these big stylistic differences between Mitt Romney and Rick Perry, but because they'll both be dealing with the same kind of Republican base, if elected, I'm not sure there'd be much distinction between either. Much in the same way that if Hillary Clinton had been the nominee instead of Barack Obama and had won the presidency, I'm not actually convinced that Clinton's presidency would look any different than Obama's presidency, or at least on the big items. That Mitt Romney, probably more so than Perry, will be so concerned with making sure he doesn't alienate the GOP base that he just, on most issues on the agenda, hews to the established consensus.
So I slightly disagree with that, which is because I think Romney is, at his core, he's – well, all he believes in is giving people what they want.
right.
And that's a good thing for, you know, an effective thing, a useful thing for a politician. Good, maybe not the best word there, but that makes him an effective politician in certain ways. And it means that he's comfortable enough giving the current GOP base what it wants. And when I say the base, I mean not just sort of the Tea Party types, but also some of the more moderate Republicans and he's really done a pretty good job of splitting the difference between those two, of accepting that the Tea Party has a big influence on the Republican Party right now, but that it is not the only influence, and that there are other people out there. And so he's, you know, you can actually, I think, read the Romney campaign as sort of a consultant's report, a readout on the state of the Republican Party right now.
Right.
But because of that, because he's just there to, because all he wants is to give other people what they want. I think that he might be a little more willing to negotiate, a little more process oriented once he actually got to the White House. Yeah. Than a guy like Rick Perry, who clearly doesn't care all that much about irritating his opponents.
Right.
He's more of a deal maker and more of a governor than a lot of people think, that seem to think. You know, he's not simply a crazy radical.
Right.
But he also doesn't have any problem seems to quite like ticking off the other side and pushing their buttons. And Romney doesn't. And so
right.
Romney, you know, from a governance perspective, might be a little more conciliatory towards Democrats while at the same time trying to, you know, keep the support of his base. It would be interesting to see him try to juggle all of those balls.
Right. I mean, I really think if Romney is elected president, his behavior will almost entirely depend on who's controlling Congress. And right now it looks like you could see sort of just a complete reversal in the current political makeup of the government, where Republicans take the White House and the Senate and Democrats take the House. And in which case, I do think, Romney would definitely be more conciliatory, more willing to just because he doesn't care that much, just cut the deal to get the bill, whatever he can do. Though, of course, if the economy, sure, the I wouldn't say funny, but sort of like the interesting thing about all of this is that if the economy doesn't really improve in 4 years, then like you can Romney will probably end up being one-term president as well. That as long as sort of the economy is stagnant over the next decade, I think there's a very good chance you see these sort of large turnovers every 2 to 4 years, where presidents last a single term. You know, there's like consecutive wave elections, just a little more instability than usual in terms of the partisan makeup of a government.
So this brings us to the next topic that we wanted to talk about, which is, you know, this question that I think both of us have had in offline conversations about whether the economy is really going to be the best predictor of the outcome in 2012.
Right. It's, you know, there's sort of course, you know, obviously the economy plays a big part in, you know, the outcome of a presidential
right.
election.
There's hopefully no question it's a major factor, no matter what.
But is it determinative, right? Like, yeah, are we going to hew to this view that because the economy is bad, therefore Obama will automatically lose? Or is the situation we're in so unique that that's not – the economy isn't enough? It's sufficient for Obama to lose, but it's not – or it's necessary for Obama to lose. But it's not
we haven't been in a recession like this,
right.
You know, in – really in modern political history. And
right.
So it's hard to know exactly how it will play,
right.
You know, at the polls. The other thing, though, is it's not just that the economy is unusual this coming year. It's that the GOP field is really weak for
right.
You know, considering how potentially vulnerable Obama is,
right.
And how widespread the, you know, the belief is that he can be beaten. And so that is, to some extent, what I wonder is, can Obama be beaten by a candidate that no one really likes? And
right.
Romney seems to be that candidate who there are just not that many people who really think Romney is a great candidate. There are a bunch of people who think he would be fine.
Right. No, that sounds about right. And there are, you know, right now in the GOP primary, Romney looks like the safest choice, one with the least weaknesses. But there are things about Romney that in a general election, I think become real issues. And, you know, say what you will about President Obama's recent rhetoric, you know, attacking millionaires and billionaires and all that jazz. But it puts Romney in the crosshairs if he's a nominee. Where you have a president who, you know, at that point may have been on this, I think what he called himself, a warrior for the middle class, on this path for 6 months, 7 months, against a Republican nominee who is worth a lot of money and who would be defending explicitly the tax breaks that Obama's attacking and that are unpopular with a lot of Americans. I'm not sure that that's the sort of thing that would like determine the election, but things like that.
I think that's going to be
a
harder attack for Obama to make, simply because Obama himself is not exactly middle
class.
He's not
middle class.
He's not worth $100 million or $350 million or whatever it is that Romney's worth.
I think
not
Romney's like
close.
$250 million.
But Obama is not someone who now or ever will have money troubles, or anything like them,
right.
And so that is going to dilute the issue to some extent. Also, Americans are fairly used to right and left are fairly used to presidents who are well off to very well off.
Right. True. No. Absolutely.
And so I wonder the comparison to the best comparison to a guy like Romney that. I've been, you know, that I can think of, and that's been going around has been Kerry in a lot of ways, and maybe you can sort of explain this better than I can. You know, no one in at least GOP elites don't really like Romney all that much, and the GOP base doesn't really like Romney all that much. They think at best, like I said, he's fine. Do you think that the that the antipathy or sort of the lack of enthusiasm about Kerry was as strong, you know, or as weak, whatever, as the, you know, was equal to the lack of enthusiasm about Romney?
I think it's probably about the same. Back in 04, I think sort of the party mood is about the same. Back in 04, the thing Democrats wanted to do more than anything was just to beat George W. Bush. And so they chose John Kerry as the guy who on the surface seemed like he'd be best positioned to beat George W. Bush. You know, moderate on foreign policy. Sure,
but
moderate
still,
Kerry
seems like a little bit better of a standard bearer for the Democratic agenda than a guy like Romney, who passed the predecessor to Obamacare, who, you know, governed a big liberal state, and doesn't stand for anything. And there is no one who believes that he is a man of great policy convictions.
Right. I mean, I think the analogy with Kerry is actually really good, because remember, if Obamacare is the, you know, issue for Republicans today, in 2004 it was Iraq, and John Kerry voted for the Iraq War, and, you know, he said he hit the famous I voted for it, but sort of the same that the Iraq looms so large in the Democratic Party as sort of like the core issue, that the mere fact that Kerry was something of a supporter, like, tainted him, like, dampened enthusiasm for him. And I think, you know, I think it's a similar position Romney's in, on sort of the number one issue among Republicans. Romney is, at best, heterodox, and at worst, essentially in the same boat as Obama. It's really a question of how much do Republicans want to beat Obama? Do they want to beat him so bad that stuff just doesn't matter? Or does it matter enough that Romney would, you know, suffer in terms of enthusiasm or something here and there? I don't know. But I do think that Romney probably is the Kerry figure for the Republican Party. And it's entirely possible that, you know, he could lose the election because it's just, you know, he can't make enough of a distinction, you know? Like, John Kerry's problem in part was that John Kerry
didn't
really
present
that much
of a choice. It's going to be hard to get enthusiastic about Romney for anyone.
Right.
For independents, you know, for the conservative base, for, you know, sort of the prototypical, you know, suburban upper middle class Republican who likes Republicans, votes Republicans, but is not, you know, not into this whole Tea Party thing. Who, I mean, like, in fact, that's, if anything, that group is probably Romney's base, but they're not going to look at Romney and be like, yeah, I really like that guy.
No one.
Awesome. He's going to fix everything. They're going to look at him and go, his best bet, his hope is that they will look at Romney and go, well, he's better than Obama.
Right. Exactly.
He couldn't be worse.
Exactly.
On the other hand, you know, what did Dave Weigel tweet? I don't know. I think it was this morning, within the last day or so, was that Romney is Kerry, and if unemployment had been 9% when Kerry was running for president, then Kerry would have beaten Bush.
Right. But I mean, even that's not a clear sort of correspondence, right? Because had Bush began his term with a massive economic collapse, right? Then, you know, that's, you know, unemployment was 9%.
The tech bubble, you know, sort of pretty much died there, and September 11th wasn't exactly great for the economy.
Right, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a great recession.
Sure, it's not the same, but it wasn't as if Bush rode out, you know, started near the top of a mountain and climbed even further.
Right. I don't know, just I find this election, I'm increasingly wary of predictions about the general election, because I just find there are too many variables, there are too many things we don't know, and there's sort of the ever-present problem that there haven't been that many presidential elections, period. So,
right.
You know,
small sample size, it's true.
Right, there's a very small sample size. We're not really sure what... We have a good idea of what is predictive, and, you know, doing cross-national studies, we have a sense of, you know, the economy does really count and things like this, but, you know...
And it's made a lot smaller by the fact that that elections 150 years ago don't tell us a whole lot about elections today, and
right.
even elections 70 years ago tell us less, you know, than we might like about elections today. So,
and,
you know,
and then there's the fact that
modern elections is pretty small. It's true,
right? And then there's the fact that, you know, really when it boils down to it, a presidential election is 50 separate state elections, and so
right. That
you know. That Obama is a you know, mildly unpopular nationwide doesn't really tell you that much about what will happen in the seven or eight states that are necessary for either candidate to win.
Let's talk about Obama here, and in particular, let's talk about the fact that it's 50 separate state elections. You know, because on the one side we have this very weak, you know, sort of, or at least very mediocre GOP field that is not inspiring anyone. But my read of the Obama administration in the last couple of weeks is that they are very nervous, and that they are, you know, in part because they are deploying a slightly weird. A strategy that seems very targeted towards getting out the base, a base that is not very enthusiastic about them. It's like, I mean, as far as I can tell, they haven't quite given up on independence, but I think the Obama administration recognizes that their sort of independence, their edge with independence with groups that are not traditionally, don't traditionally lean Democrat, is obviously not going to be nearly as strong as it was last time around, and maybe, you know, all but gone,
right.
Which is why they are, you know, they're now saying that they're running a 50-state strategy, that you shouldn't expect them to just go after, you know, the obvious Democratic path to victory, that they're going to be going after all of the states, you know, which what does that tell you is that they're taking a long shot. They're taking
right.
a harder path because they think the easy, you know, the normal path is not going to work for them.
Right.
And
if
you can
I,
read
if
that
I were...
into the... Sorry, go ahead.
And if I were a campaign strategist for Obama, I would really stop saying things like that in public. It's just it doesn't.
No.
You know, and you're right. It sounds like they're very, very nervous about what's going to happen. And I mean, they're right to be, but you shouldn't voice those concerns in public. It makes you look nervous.
Especially the way they're doing it, which is by suggesting that all of these signs are weaknesses. They're just sort of asserting that all these signs of weakness are somehow signs of strength.
Right,
and this is
right.
the message that's coming out is we're going to be running a campaign that suggests, you know, that strongly implies that we know we're in trouble. At the same time, we're going to be telling you that we're doing that because we're in such a good position.
Right.
And it's, you know, it just... I don't get what they're getting at with this. You know, I do understand that they're looking to rile up the base and that they think they've got some issues that they can get the base motivated on. The jobs bill, you know, was part of that. The big jobs speech.
Oh yeah, that was
the
very almost certainly
job speech.
That was a campaign speech. The job speech,
right.
The subsequent speech. Those were all campaign speeches, definitely aimed at. Energizing Democrats to vote.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when the jobs speech, you know, when passed this bill, when that speech was given, a lot of folks instantly read it. You know, the quick read was that this was a play for independence. And certainly the Obama administration would like to get independence and would like to pick up, you know, the why can't Washington just do something and get moving folks.
Right.
But it really sounded to me, it really read a lot more to me as a play for the base. And then
oh, yeah,
especially
definitely.
Once you saw the deficit reduction proposal that was, you know, it was $4 trillion with a $1 trillion war gimmick. It was half taxes of the Medicare cuts. You know, more than half of the Medicare cuts came out of the drug companies.
Right.
You know, sort of, you know, a smaller version of the price of the negotiations that they've been trying to implement in Medicare Part D for forever, or at least since Medicare Part D passed. All stuff that was designed to reach out to an unmotivated base. And so this whole thing, it looks like they're just sort of crossing their fingers and hoping that the committed liberals will come out for them.
I happen to think that that's probably the right strategy. I mean, regardless, that even if economic conditions weren't as bad, the simple fact is that Republicans, the other side's always very energized to vote against an incumbent president who's from the other party. And so sort of the first order of things, it's just to, like, get your side just as excited to vote for the guy.
Right. Maybe they'll pull back and they'll run a much more independent focused strategy. Well, certainly they will. I think it's probably a guarantee that by sometime next summer they'll be running a strategy somewhat more focused on independence.
I don't think they'll pull back that much though. I think they're gonna, given how bad the administration is on sticking on a message, and given that they've been sticking on the same message for so long, I think that we're going to see this one extend well into next year, and it's going to, coincide with the administration's or the campaign's what's likely to be very strong get out the vote effort, and getting voters registered, getting people to the polls.
They're planning now. You can see if you look at they made the decision recently to go ahead and ask the Supreme Court to hear the Obamacare mandate, the individual health insurance mandate case this next session, which
right.
would, which if the Supreme Court goes ahead and does this, which I think is the most likely thing at this point by far, then that means that we will get a decision on the constitutionality of the individual mandate next summer.
Right.
And regardless of which way that decision goes, that decision is going to mean that Obama will be running on that the mandate, not just the healthcare law, but the mandate in particular, is going to be a big part of the conversation starting in the middle of next summer.
Right. I guarantee what the administration will say or what they'll do is something like, if you vote against us, then the health insurance for your 20-something and all these things that, like, you want are going to go away. And that's, that's regardless of if the Supreme Court upholds the mandate, if it strikes it down. Because if it strikes it down, there are conceivable things you could do. And then the pitch becomes, if you reelect me, we can put us back on a path to where, your health insurance is protected and all that jazz.
If the mandate – so side issue, if the mandate goes down, I think it's very, very unlikely. I think it's basically impossible that the Supreme Court will strike down the rest of the law. They may take out the guaranteed issue and community rating provisions, that require policies to be sold at more or less the same price to everyone, and that insurers have to take all comers. But simplified version, yes, I'm aware of that. I don't think it's I think the healthcare law will still be there no matter what the Supreme Court decides.
Right, right.
We won't end up in a situation where the law is just gone.
Right. No, and what I'm saying is that the administration will pitch – not that the healthcare law will be entirely gone, but that they'll say, without the mandate, this can't work as well. So if you elect us again, then we'll find some way to make it work as well. We'll repair what was damaged.
Right, but this is so clearly a base-driven strategy.
Oh yeah,
because this is it seems like an odd strategy for a big general election to run on the strength of a bill that, yes, biggest accomplishment, most prominent accomplishment, that's not arguable. On the other hand, it has been consistently not popular. And the mandate in particular. So, you can get support for the healthcare law, to head, close to 50%, mid 40s, upper 40s every now and then, although right now, I think it's right around 40. But you can't get that kind of support for the mandate. And the mandate
right.
is what is going to be talked about after the Supreme Court releases its decision, and the mandate is going to be the focus. And this just seems like a really weird way to bring attention back to the health, you know, to that law and to the most unpopular part of it.
Right.
And but that's a fight that they've decided they're going to go out of their way. You know, Republicans were going to pick that fight anyway, but they're going to bring that. You know, they're going to take that fight.
I mean, maybe, you know, maybe it's just better in the end. If Republicans are going to bring it anyway, maybe it's better in the end just to get ahead of it and like, position yourself.
Yeah. And it's also true that, you know, if that they want to make sure that they're the ones who are arguing the case,
right?
You know, and that they want to do that now rather than after 2012, when they might not be around to defend it, and a Romney or Perry or administration or whatever would probably be a little less enthusiastic about defending that law and the mandate.
Right.
So I don't know if you have anything else to say about Obama 2012, the Republican field here, if we've missed anything.
I have one more thing to say, and this is just like idle speculation and me being way too much of a pundit, but
that's your job.
But it'd be interesting to see how if the Obama ticket changes any, you know, the murmurs are that Hillary Clinton really does not want to be Secretary of State anymore. And I can sort of imagine a world where Obama asked Joe Biden to sort of like retire and Hillary Clinton joins the ticket. And I'm not sure if that would reek of desperation if done poorly, it would reek of desperation. If done well, I could imagine it being the sort of thing that really energizes Democrats, you know? Because Hillary Clinton's sort of the other, you know, towering figure in the Democratic Party. And I do think it would excite a lot of Democrats if they may not be super enthused to vote for Obama, but they'd definitely be happy to vote for Hillary Clinton.
This is like when Superman and Batman, at the end of the Superman versus Batman miniseries, have to team up to fight off Darkseid.
Right, basically.
I mean, it's the team up, you know, sort of dream team strategy here. You know, that sort of thing, it's always a fan favorite. And you make an interesting point about Biden. He's not exactly a liability for the Obama administration on the ticket, but he's not really much of a help at this point.
Right. And if the goal is to just...
He doesn't really add anything.
And if the goal is to gin up enthusiasm, then, I mean, it might be worth looking to replace Biden. If that's sort of your singular goal, to make sure that as close to 100% Democrats get out the vote as possible. Because if that happens, you know, if Obama can maintain enthusiasm levels just like, even just slightly south of 2008, then he's in a very strong position.
The Hillary Clinton thing actually is a little bit interesting. And she has, you know, to some extent, I wonder if she would be willing to take that role, but she has so far actually been very, very willing not just to take roles that are, you know, sort of to take the role of the secretary to do what she's doing now, to run for senator, but then actually to sort of commit herself to doing those jobs and trying to do them well and be
right.
A good public servant in those jobs. Not that I agree with a lot of her decisions, but she seems actually to be taking what she does very seriously rather than simply using those positions as stepping stones.
I mean, she's
somewhere else.
She's kind of a team player.
Yeah, she is. So it's totally plausible that could end up happening. Right, that could change the race a little bit. But I do kind of, you know, I do wonder. In a 9% unemployment environment,
right.
Is the addition of, you know, that's what it comes back to. And we as long as we keep having these conversations, we're going to keep coming back to that number, 9%
right.
Unemployment. And as long as that number is still there, I'm a little wary that Republicans can capitalize it, but I'm also a little wary, you know, a little skeptical that there's a lot that Obama can do to mitigate the damage that will inevitably result from a number like that.
And that is why I called it idle pundit speculation.
Yes. But that, like I said, that's what we're here for.
Right.
So a different kind of punditry here. I know you have thoughts on the not iPhone 5.
Right.
We're supposed to get Chris Christie. You know, we were hoping for Chris Christie to run for president and for the iPhone 5 to be released yesterday. And, you know, nada. It was a big non nothing day.
So I really wasn't surprised by that. Because the only people talking about an iPhone 5 were the tech press. Like, Apple has said nothing about what their plans were. They'd only said that there will be a new iPhone. And right. So sort of like the fever pitch for an iPhone 5 is really, I actually think it's a failure of the tech press to keep a lid on its enthusiasm for Apple. Like, we know you really like those guys, but the constant rumor generation, the sort of like constant assumptions that everything from Apple will be new and transformative, sort of like you're playing with your readers' expectations in a way that will leave them disappointed regardless of what happens.
It really is exactly what a lot of the political press did with Chris Christie.
Right. You know, it's a mirror image. It's not a mirror image. It's just an exact correspondence that.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you were taking a sober look at Apple, then I don't know what else you would have been expecting. It fits with what's becoming, I think, the pattern, which is, you know, there's the original iPhone, and then there's the iPhone 3G, which is like a big jump up. And then there is what's sort of just a minor revision, the iPhone 3GS. There's it's a little faster, the camera's better. Sort of it's the iPhone for people who didn't get the iPhone 3G, but want something a bit newer. The iPhone 4, then that's sort of if it's on a 2-year cycle, the iPhone 4 is the big jump up, and now we're back to the next revision, the iPhone 4S. A little faster, it's a better camera. It's for people who had bought a 3GS and now want to, their 2-year contracts are up, now want to upgrade. And then next year we'll see the iPhone 5, which is for people who bought the iPhone 4, and it's again the next jump up. And in 2013 it'll be a 5S. And so as long as Apple's making iPhones, I think that will be the how they approach it. And it's how they approach all their products, right? Like, the iPad 2 isn't really a big jump up from the iPad. It's thinner, a little faster.
It's like a whole 4 millimeters thinner, though.
Right.
So much better.
MacBooks,
my life was
changed. Like,
yeah,
they're usually cosmetic designs followed by sort of like a natural progression, and like major cosmetic designs only come out over after every three. Like, the current MacBook Pro design was introduced in, I think, 2009, and it's expected to undergo a major revision next year. So there you go.
So I admit to being a little bit sympathetic with those folks who were not super enthusiastic about the 4S here. There's not a lot to get all that enthusiastic about. On the other hand, my question for the Farhad Manjus, who really, Farhad wrote a piece, something to the effect of, this is it, really? And we saw just endless variation on, this is all we got? You didn't get me a better Christmas present? But, like, what problem were they hoping for the iPhone 5 to solve? Like, what is it that the iPhone – and I don't say this as like I'm a little bit of a – I am a heavy Mac user. But what was it that they were hoping for? The corollary to that is that that Apple could have significantly boosted public reception simply by changing up the form factor a little bit and perhaps including a very slightly bigger screen. Because if people got the exact same internal package with a little bit of a different form factor, a little bit different hardware, a cooler new look, somehow whatever, I think that's what they were, that would have pleased a lot of the critics. Maybe not all of them, but certainly a lot of them. And it sort of suggests how much of this, of the expectation is just set based on, pure aesthetic appeal and, sort of the outward appearance of the hardware.
Right. So here's why I think they didn't change how the hardware looked. So if you look at, a lot of people own smartphones, but the vast majority of people don't. I mean, 70% of people don't. And the iPhone 4 for Apple is their highest selling iPhone iteration. Right. And I think the way Apple approached it was that, look, our iPhone 4 is very popular. The design is very popular. There's still a lot of people who don't own iPhones. So rather than immediately going to a new design, let's hold on to this one for one more year and sort of get the people who want this design, which is, a very large potential market of people, and get an iPhone in their hands. It's cheaper for Apple to do this because they're not changing designs. I guarantee that there is a new design iPhone being tested and used on, you know, in Apple's campus in preparation for the iPhone 5 next
probably
year.
Probably several models.
Yeah, probably several models.
They're probably having them stand on stage and ask her, and answer really inane questions, perhaps bringing in John King to sort of go every now and then.
The other thing is, you know, all the funny thing to me is all the problems that exist with prior iPhone iterations, and they're not hardware related, they're all software related. The poor notification system, and that's sort of the big one. Like, it's a huge pain to be on your phone doing something, and maybe you get a Twitter notification, you're like, oh, it's a tweet. And before you can even hit view, you get a text, and you lose that notification, and all of a sudden, like, you have this new text you have to deal with. Lots of big software updates have come with the iPhone 4S, and I think, you know, that's sort of where Apple was hoping to generate the enthusiasm that, look, the iPhone looks the same, and we think it's a great design. But, hey, we have completely revised the new software, and it's big changes that will really improve how you use the phone.
I suspect that the next major overhaul in the iPhone will probably coincide with more, you know, a better availability and more robust 4G networks. And that,
right.
You know, and that's really what – that's a big part of the holdup is that they are still, you know, with AT&T, which is the bulk of their subscriber of the iPhone base, AT&T, you know, is still in the very early stages of figuring out what to do with 4G. It's a 3G device at this point. You can't count on 4G availability in most places.
Right. And since it's very clear that Apple's priority with all their mobile devices is battery life, if you take apart an iPad, it's like really just a giant battery with some components attached. That as long as Apple will have 4G for their phones, and they can design a phone that gets great battery life and also 4G. Until that comes, I don't think there'll be 4G networks on Apple phones.
So I am happy actually that that it was only a 4S, because it means that, you know, I don't feel quite as like status anxious about my measly old iPhone 4.
Same.
And so it's gonna save me some money and save me some, you know, Apple cult member anxiety that, you know, where I won't feel so bad about not living up to whatever the latest creation is.
What I will say about the 4S, though, as a photography nerd, is that the camera in that thing is actually, like, really impressive.
Yeah.
In that it's maybe not worth the $100 I'd have to spend to upgrade, but for someone on the fence about getting an iPhone, of upgrading from a 3GS or something, I'd say do it for the camera.
Also, greeting cards.
Oh, yes, greeting cards. Thank you. Man, when I saw that, even I for a second was just like, wow, really? Like, this is
everybody
not...
sends greeting cards. It's a big market, man.
I don't know if you've got
more to say, I'll let you go.
I was just going to make a joke.
Well, I guess we're about finished up then. Chris Christie, the iPhone 4S, sorry, Obama, you know, lots of uncertainty here. It was very nice talking to you, and hope we get to do this again soon.
Absolutely.
Nice talking to you, sir. Have a good one.
Peace.